Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Smell something?
Put that cookie down!
Hello and welcome back to the Mighty Motion Picture Rangers, and it's a welcome back for the last time. You heard that right. This is the series finale, and in true fashion, who doesn't love to end things on a top 10 list? So we're doing a top 10 films of 2020, the year that was interesting to say the least. We'll have some, so Josh is recording separate from us here, but in the studio we have our wonderful returning guest, Mr. Peter Gray. Hello, hello.
Hello.
Oh, I remember picking, I think that was my pick, and then Chanster's was the Ghostbusters one, and Josh's was the Put the Cookie Down from the intro. Those were the salad days. That was like a few years ago now, but we've had a big break anyway between this episode and the last one. But we'll be like working on future projects and not quitting podcasting. I'm doing like a fiction podcast, like a horror narrative audio drama thing. So I'm going to spend more time focusing on that. That's going to occupy a lot of time, as well as writing scripts and maybe a book.
That does not surprise me at all.
It's going to be hopefully cool. But we are doing a top 10 of 2020 films. And anyone who's heard our previous ones, we have our little pattern that we go. We got honorable mentions, and then we do in groups of three up to our final one. We'll start with you, and we'll go you, me, and then I'll throw to Josh's recordings, and then we'll come back and keep going there. So I guess we should just dig into it, because I tried to limit my top 10. I actually found this year, I don't know about you, did you find this year it was good?
Like, I found this year really hard to narrow down, and I think it's funny because everyone's like, oh, the cinema's closed, like you'd have nothing to do. I'm like, busiest year ever.
Right.
Like, because I think so many studios and so many companies are like, no, we want our movie to be seen, so we really need to extend this out to the media.
Yeah. Oh,
so
okay.
I was seeing things that in a normal year probably never would have seen.
Yeah, and you got your South by Southwest. You're wearing the shirt now.
And I got Sundance the other day, which
that's
is
so cool.
Very exciting.
And did you do another one? Did you get TIFF as well?
I didn't get TIFF. I got the AFI Festival.
Oh, nice.
And I did New York, Tribeca as well.
Right. Oh, sweet.
So this year's been like, yeah, it's, I was like, I know that everyone's, you know.
I guess being online, it let them open it
up. It really did. So now I'm just hoping that'll transfer to physical whenever physical things come back. But yeah.
But no, I found that too. I found like, without studio films in the way, I got to see a lot of tiny little itty bitty films. Way more films directed by women came to the forefront, and it's telling that you have to get rid of studio films in order to do that. Way more queer films.
Yes, queer cinema was like
on fire.
It just
this year.
Thrived in 2020. So
yeah,
keep
Cause it's
that
always
up.
Been in those spaces always, yeah. anyway, and it's just because no one has the time because they're busy watching, you know.
And they're like, we can't give these monies any movie to promote. But now you're like, well, you probably should, because we're usually quite well reviewed as well. Queer cinema has been like always up in the echelons this year. So
yeah. So I guess, what are your honorable mentions, Peter?
Well, I'm going to just quickly sort of be a bit unorthodox, but one of my honorable mentions will be, I saw this great little selection of short films that were from South by Southwest.
Oh, cool.
One of them has actually been commissioned to become a full length movie. Mm. So it'd be kind of cool to see how that ends up. But yes. So one of them was called Selfie, which is the one that's getting extended. It's really telling, because it's like people that are on TikTok and Snapchat and Instagram, how they present this certain image to the world. Right. And the movie is like just basically saying how damaging that is. And it's all about this girl who takes photos of herself and then she like augments the photo so that she looks more perfect.
Right.
And then the photo and that image like comes to life and basically like murders her.
Oh,
and
wow.
And it's all about like how your image can destroy yourself. And it was like 5 minutes long and it was,
that's cool.
It's so creepy. And I'm so glad that this one's getting, you know, made into a feature length because it could be
Blumhouse one.
I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if they latched onto that
really well.
But yeah, like it was just, and usually short films, I'm kind of like, you know, can give or take, but I was like, you know what? I'm going to see these. And they were just some of the, I was like, these are the filmmakers that we need to be behind because they've got limited budget and a limited time, but they know how to make every bit work.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So is that your honorable mention?
Well, and then one of my other honorable mentions probably is Birds of Prey.
Oh, nice.
Because
that'll be making an appearance.
Oh my God. That movie was just like, I really thought it was going to be, I mean, it's just out of the top 10 because there were actually a lot of great little things that came through. But, you know, in a year when we didn't have too many superhero movies.
Oh, no. Oh, terrible. I remember when there was an article that said, like, this will be the first year in X amount of years that no Marvel film has been released. And we're like, thank God.
You're like, okay, that's fine. But, no, like, I just love that they gave Cathy Yan and Margot Robbie very much free reign. Like, this isn't a typical DC, you know, structured movie. I just love that they went for an R rating.
Candy-coloured, violent.
Like, hilarious. Like, I'm like, I'm sorry, if you're going to give Ryan Reynolds a Golden Globe nomination for Deadpool, you should be giving a Golden Globe nomination for Margot Robbie.
Yeah. 100%. 100%.
Like, that won't happen because...
No.
Why would it?
Remember they were talking about cancelling the Oscars? I'm like, why? Because you're finally getting some really great films up in there?
Like, we don't feel sorry for you that you have more to choose from because now you might actually see that there's great stuff out there.
Yeah.
That you actually have to watch because we all know that the Academy... don't watch all the movies that they're meant to.
They don't. They just watch the ones that get the most buzz and then just vote for them. Some of them don't even watch and they just vote anyway.
Oh.
Have you ever seen those anonymous Oscar voter and you just want to just stab your eyes out when you read
the fact that, like, last year, like, it was... I was very much a barracker for Jennifer Lopez getting nominated for Hustlers. I did not make that a secret at all. and, you know, they had this quote from one of the Academy voters who was just like, well, I'm not going to watch a stripper movie. Ugh. And you're like, it's not a stripper movie. It's Goodfellas just set in a strip club, which would probably get people to watch it.
Yeah, if it was men.
Yeah. You know? If you haven't seen Hustlers and you think it's just a stripper movie with Jennifer Lopez, it's not.
No.
It's so much more than that.
It's a really good
movie. It's really great.
So my honorable mentions, I tried to limit my list. I actually culled like five off this. It's long.
Yeah.
I have Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which is the Viola Davis Netflix Chadwick Boseman one. And it's based on an August Wilson play. And it tells, I really like that it tells the story of just like one day. Have you seen this one?
I have, yes.
Yeah, it just tells this one day in the studio recording thing. And then all of this sort of stuff happens. And it's very... play based.
It is. I was watching going, this is very much a play.
But I didn't really care that much because they put these like cinematic scaffolding around it, like with the way they cut away. You know, when someone's doing a speech and they start cutting away to just these people on the street or something like that, I found that really good. And I like theater anyway, so I wasn't like, this is bad. It's just a filmed play, which is what everyone seemed to be complaining. And Chadwick just... throw the Oscars at him, like,
yeah.
Like,
and I mean,
rest in peace.
Let's hope that there isn't the conversation that he's only getting nominated because he passed away. I'm like, he would be in the race,
which they
regardless.
Didn't say to Heath Ledger.
No, so yeah.
And Viola Davis too. Like, she's not a prominent in that film, and yet she dominates it despite having like next to no screen time.
And like, for some reason, I was just like, I can't hear the word Coca-Cola without thinking of Viola Davis now.
Yeah. And it was queer too. I didn't know that about Ma Rainey, which goes to show, but like, I was like, oh, this is a queer film too, in a lot of ways.
Which is, you know,
yes.
Suck it.
Yes. Next up, Dating Amber. Have you seen this one?
I have not.
It is an Irish high school film about a gay boy and a gay girl who then fake date each other to get the students off their back. And it is joyful, and it it has an energy to it that I feel is like lacking from a lot of like modern high school movies that are trying to be, you know, Fault in Our Stars-esque intense and dramatic. Written and directed by David Frayne, and it's pure joy. The actress in it, whose name has escaped me right now, she's fantastic in it. Okay. It is just like one of my favorite sort of queer films, and it was really hard because this was in my top 10 and then got knocked down along with Breaking Fast, which is in my honorable mention. Will this be making an appearance
later?
Yes, it will. Well, I won't say too much, but written and directed by Mike Mosleh, and it's the Ramadan gay rom-com that we needed.
Yes, that you never knew you needed.
Yes. It's wonderful. And I just spent that whole movie with like a shit-eating grin on my face.
Yeah.
Like, I loved it. I loved it from beginning to end. I was so thankful I got to see it through Q Screen, the Sydney Queer Film Festival.
Yeah.
They did it online, and so I was actually able to screen these things. I really hope that these festivals do online permanently now, because I hate that I can't access them from Brisbane, which never plays anything until like a year and a half later.
Yeah. No, yeah, I think we're in the sort of the middle of a big change. Like, obviously, we want physical festivals to come back. And we were very lucky that we actually got BIFF physically this year.
Yeah.
But I do think that they should keep the online option for people that...
For critics that, as well. Yeah, it only gets more publicity.
Yeah.
Host is one of my next ones, which is the horror one, the one that lasts like 50 minutes.
Yes.
And it was just a slice of, oh, I didn't realize you could do this, and that's what a movie could be, and it can be fun and scary and creepy and cool.
And incredibly like topical because of Zoom, because no one knew what Zoom was before 2020.
Yeah. And I'm so glad they've got now like a 3-picture deal with Blumhouse. Can't wait to see what they do.
Yeah.
Gretel and Hansel. And this one was the last one to leave my top 10 list. It seems to be divisive. A lot of people don't love it, but it's sort of this synth amber lit retelling of Hansel and Gretel from Osgood Perkins, who I haven't seen anything else he's done.
Yeah.
Apparently he's quite divisive.
All I really know about him is he's Anthony Perkins' son.
Oh, wow.
And he was really weird in Legally Blonde. And that
Who's
was
he in Legally Blonde?
He's the
awkward guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
No way. Yeah. Oh, there you go. Well, Gretel and Hansel is fantastic, and it's got the...
It's Sophia Lillis, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yes. The actress from It.
It, yes.
And I loved this. It's so beautifully... Every frame could be like a Rembrandt painting hanging on a gallery wall. It's beautifully done, and it leans very hard on fable and fairy tale things. Like even, much like The Witch, the dialogue is heightened to a way that's very unnatural.
Which would add to the divisiveness, because we all know how people felt about The Witch.
Yes. I've got Never Rarely, Sometimes Always. Again, this was on my top 10, but I hesitate to say it's a great film, because it's not like pop on the popcorn and enjoy this thing. This is just going to make you horrendously uncomfortable.
Yeah, I struggled with this one. It'll make an appearance later on, but it was,
it's so hard to watch. But Eliza Hittman, who did, have you seen Beach Rats?
Yes.
Yes. Same director. And when I saw Beach Rats, I'm like, yep, 100%, let's go and watch. And then before I saw this one, I saw her first film, which is called It Felt Like Love. And just like this one, it is horrendously uncomfortable. I like that she's just going to go there and not care, but a phenomenal lead performance.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And if anyone hasn't seen Eliza Hittman's stuff, Beach Rats is on Netflix in Australia at the moment.
It's on Netflix or Stan it's definitely on one of the streaming services.
Very good and very queer and wonderful.
Yeah.
I have The Surrogate, written and directed by Jeremy Hirsch.
Yeah, The Surrogate.
This is another film that's going to make people
conflicted.
But what a lead performance. What a lead performance. She should be up there with Viola and up there with all these people. She's not going to be, which is a shame because she just owns that film and those scenes, and she's so good in it, and I want to see her do like literally anything.
Because I saw this with South by Southwest, and it was one of those ones that like they offered it to me, and I was like, yep, you know what, I'm gonna watch it, not knowing literally nothing, because like South by was where it like first screened, and I was sitting there going, like, just shut up. But at the same time, no, I completely...
She has a point.
You have a point. But then, like, they have a point too, because you understand their struggle with not necessarily wanting to have a child that could have Down
maybe
syndrome.
Maybe not having the finances.
You know,
to deal
like
with
you
it
get
properly,
it, but it's just so you're on both of their sides. But
it doesn't have a black and white.
No,
it's just all grey.
But
Jasmine Batchelor is her name, and she's phenomenal.
But, oh my God, some of those conversations, you're just sitting there going, like, it's literally like you're a fly on the wall and you're just like, oh, I need to look away, but I can't because.
I almost was in part of the post crowdfunding campaign for this.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Jim Cummings, who did Wolf of Snow Hollow and all that, was helping Jeremy Hirsch sort of put together that and helping spruik that kind of thing. But the lead performance in that, it's worth the movie, even if you don't like the movie as a whole.
And then even if you don't like her character, there's no way that you can say that's a bad performance. Probably the reason that you hate her so much is because she's so great at what she does.
Yeah, it's top five performances, not main female, just top five performance of the year for
me. And again, queer cinema.
Yes, 110% yes. The assistant. Another one of those horrifically... Am I stealing your top tens or no?
No. No. But like all the movies you're mentioning, Ella, were all ones that were just like...
horrendously uncomfortable. Oh, this one.
And I'm hearing that Julia Garner is... Her name is sort of being tossed around. And I really hope so.
So this one, for anyone who doesn't know, tells the story of basically a day in the life of a PA at an office of a very, very thinly veiled Harvey Weinstein analog.
There's no way that you can watch this and go, oh, this has nothing to do. It's like, it's absolutely
And they refer to him as him.
As him.
And you never see him in the film. His presence is there.
You hear him
and you see him like in silhouette.
And he's horrible when you hear him. He's so manipulative when he forget, like when he's like, I'm sorry.
And makes her apologize via email. Oh. And then the bit where the guys go over her shoulder to tell her I just wanted to like shrivel up. But this has one of the best sort of wordless character introductions since There Will Be Blood. And I'm annoyed that like more people aren't talking about like that aspect of it. Cause she films almost, what's her name? Kitty Green films the thing almost entirely in just static shots, the whole movie. And then there's occasional dollies, but it's all just the static frames, perfectly framed. And just a brilliant wordless character introduction. She gets in and sets everything up and does the coffee. It's so fantastic.
Yeah. Again, another one of those fly on the wall sort of ones where, and then we get a beautiful cameo from a very beautiful actor in the elevator.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, daddy. I got Disclosure, the documentary from Netflix about trans representation in media. It's vital viewing. It's just you gotta watch it.
Yeah, never more so in 2020.
Yeah, and it would make a really great double feature. I don't know if you've seen the documentary The Celluloid Closet.
I haven't, but I know
about
it,
just representation of sort of gay relationships portrayed in media, and it makes like a perfect double feature with that one. Just because it's the same shape of a film as well. It's just fantastic. Ammonite, which is maybe a controversial pick because a lot of people didn't like it. And for the most of the viewing, I wasn't sure where I sat. I was like, oh, kind of, is this it? And then the last 5 minutes happened and just destroyed me. I was like, oh, because it managed to acknowledge things in it that I've seen in other versions of this age gap, same-sex romance period thing that don't get acknowledged in it.
Yeah.
And that final frame that stuck with me, and the little piano piece that plays over it just has haunted me since I've watched the damn film. So I had to like put it on there for that.
Yeah.
And the fantastic sex scenes, as always, Francis Lee. Francis Lee doesn't hold back, and he makes them really character-based like he did in God's Own Country. And I'm just like, just fantastic. Like you can't, like if someone's going to put a sex scene in a film, watch his work, and that's the bar, you know?
And then maybe we can stop all these conversations about how unnecessary sex scenes are.
Yeah,
in
like
cinema.
If you're not comfortable watching with your family, don't watch it with your family.
And it's no longer a hot take, people.
Yes.
Saying that you don't understand.
I think you saw that go viral this morning.
I'm like, you're like the fourth person that has said this.
Yeah.
So it's not new. And there are many movies where the sex is actually.
Watch a Disney film with your family if you
where
not,
the sex
you
is know. Actually. Vital to the story.
Sex is a part of life. It's the reason people exist.
I won't have this nonsense.
And then the last of my honourable mentions is The Personal History of David Copperfield, directed by Armando Iannucci. I actually had a blast with this one, and I came to it later. I only watched it like a week ago, and I just thought it was really joyful in a way I hadn't seen in a lot of other movies this year, other than like Dating Amber and Breaking Fast. It was just kind of joyful and there, and it was shot really well, and it's just basically this revolving door of all the British character actors that you love, and I love Tilda in this.
Oh my God.
She's so good. Which yeah, this just smooshes her face up against the glass like her first shot in. I was just like,
this was like this was one of the first movies I saw back in the cinema. So right. we had received the invite to see it just before lockdown. Mm. So the screening was cancelled, and then it was a case of we didn't know. Like it felt like it could have been one of those movies that they just then cancelled the theatrical release. Like it yeah. could have just gone straight to streaming or straight to DVD or whatever. But then it came out and I saw it in the cinemas, and yeah, it was like, again, I knew nothing about it.
Yeah.
It was, I was like, this is weird and kind of cool. Funny. And I can understand why purists will reject it yeah. because I'm like, this isn't like, if you're thinking it's going to be very traditional
British costume, British,
you know, it's like, it's not at all.
But I love the scene transitions, how he moves from one scene to another. Yeah. Like even just the opening when he goes from the theater into the field, and then the people from the theater are still there with like the lights and the podium.
Yeah.
Or you know, like the wall will blow away as a sheet, and then you're suddenly at a beach or something like that. I thought those were inspired scene yeah. transitions that really kind of elevated the piece, and it was great to see Dev Patel just smashing it. Like, yep. I can't wait for The Green Knight.
I should have.
Top 10 of next year.
I would have seen The Green Knight if South By hadn't. So you know what? If the pandemic, whatever.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get into it.
So now we'll throw to Josh. Josh, what were your honourable mentions?
Hello, it's me, Josh, the other co-host of the Mighty Motion Picture Rangers, kicking us off into listing our favourites of the year that has been 2020. I thought I would first give a few honourable mentions. Now, my list may not be as comprehensive as I would like to it has been this year, simply because this year has been rough, very rough, on all of us, and we haven't been out to the movies much. We haven't seen many new things. We drew back into old comforts, old favourites, reliable pieces, and so, but funnily enough, on the flip side of that, a lot of my list features horror, because that's the most cathartic genre of all, in my opinion. But anyway, without further ado, here's a few of my honourable mentions. The first film of my honourable mentions is Scare Me, directed by Josh Rubin, which you may know from College Humor fame. The film stars himself, and if you've watched Amazon Prime's The Boys, Aya Cash, one of the villains featured in that show, or superheroes, if you will. The film also stars Chris Redd and Rebecca Drysdale. Essentially, the film is an anthology horror story set in the wilderness, in a cabin in the woods, during a snow blizzard, and it's about two strangers, one a famous, or newly famous horror writer, and one an aspiring horror screenwriter, telling stories to scare each other. During the film, and in my opinion, this is one of the best. It came to a strange Shudder October 1st, actually, and I instantly just fell in love with it. The way it comments on just sort of ownership over stories and authorialship and, like, a voice and just the many ways sort of people who don't know how to tell stories who don't actively write or try and write stories themselves, who don't realize how complicated it is, and who feel that they are owned fame and owned praise for their stories, and who try to dictate things. And this is very much a response to Twitter, how Twitter currently, how people respond to films, respond to art on Twitter. And I feel like it was very effective, excellent use of sound design, and just like, and for like a second feature or maybe even directorial debut, I feel like the scope and how small and confined it was, but how much they got out of the space was amazing, and the performances. So kudos to Josh Rubin for that. And while I didn't wind up on my main list, it was pretty darn close. The second film of my honorable mentions list is Synchronic, directed by Aaron Moorhead and Justin Benson. They're the filmmakers of other sort of science fiction, sort of time related films such as like Spring and Resolution and The Endless, which sort of loose trilogy And this film itself concerns like two New Orleans paramedics, which when their lives are ripped apart by this new drug, or synthetic drug called Synchronic, which sort of has like otherworldly effects and sort of time effects. The leads of the film are Anthony Mackie and Jamie Dornan, and my God, Anthony Mackie is amazing in this film, and his performance and the emotion he sort of reaps from this is... Benton and Moorhead are known for their really small budgets and what they can get out and squeeze out of every penny they got, and it is more evident on display in here. Their use of transitions and camera work and editing is just simply astounding, and the fact that they predominantly do it all themselves they're in another league. I greatly admire their process, the way they move the camera, the way they move, like, use the edit and use the performances. And even though it's a lot of handheld moments that feel, in other films, would feel cheap or lesser than, like, they really get great use out of it in this film. And I highly recommend it. It is a trippy ride, something greatly enjoyable. The next film on my honorable mention is Christopher Nolan's Tenet. We sort of already know what the premise of this film was, or at least know the inkling around it. It's like, it's about time, of course, and about inversion. It's Christopher Nolan, of course it's about fucking time. The film stars John David Washington as the protagonist, Robert Pattinson, Elizabeth Debicki, Kenneth Branagh. I really dug this film. I know it's very divisive right now, but I don't know, I had a good time. There was, of course, I noticed the sound issues or the sound mix that we saw when we saw it in cinemas, because luckily in Australia we got to see it in the cinemas because it was all safe to do so. But other than that awkward mix, like, I was blown away by, like, the action, the set pieces, the sort of scope and scale. Like, I feel like this sort of delivered on all levels for me, and I could pick it apart for the many instances of, like, the dramaturgy of how Christopher Nolan uses, you know, Christopher Nolan's approach to, you know, women in his films and all of that. But aside from that kind of glaring issue, it worked. This may be on Shane's or Peter's or Zane's list, but it's certainly on mine, or at least in my honorable mentions, which holds equal sway in my opinion. The next film on my honorable mentions is Bloody Hell, directed by Alistair Grierson. And for those who don't know, it's actually a local production. I managed to see this in the cinema with Shane, which we were lucky to do so because it was dead quiet, and I did not know what I was getting into. I did not know anything about this film going in, and it kind of blew my mind. It was like a grand mix of genres, something I've never seen for sort of an Australian-based production before, and I had such a good time. This just, like, ticked nearly every box for me in terms of, like, blending and mixing of genres, of, you know, establishing multiple tones and just really just fucking with the audience, having a good time, inserting moments that shouldn't work but really making it pay off. Like, nah. And just the edit, the direction, the performances, everything. This could have fell apart so easily, but because all of those technical instances and the dramaturgy was just tightly wound just enough, it just worked, and I was immensely happy. Oh, and I guess I should elaborate too that it is essentially, it's a man who travels to a foreign country to sort of escape his past, and then he gets kidnapped, and where it goes from there, or where it came from before that, is up for you to discover.
Very nice picks. I haven't heard them yet, but I will when I hear them and edit this together, I suppose. So now we're on the top tens, and we'll do these in groups of three going around. So I guess, Peter, what are your top 10, 9, and 8?
So number 10 is the aforementioned Breaking Fast.
Yes.
Number 9 is Promising Young Woman.
Ooh, interesting. So you liked it?
I did. I understand people that don't because the ending.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much we can spoil, but like, because I saw this in cinema and I liked it, but then I was kind of like, I know, part of me felt like it was trying to validate what had happened in the end as being a positive thing,
yeah.
Not a thing that happened in spite of these things that went wrong. And I don't know that I liked that. I loved sort of what it was doing, and I loved how, like, blunt it was about things. I also, the one thing is, though, the way everyone talked about this movie, I expected the first 90 minutes of this thing to be, like, horrifically uncomfortable and violent, and then to find out that maybe it wasn't quite as bloody as it was implied to be.
Yeah.
I was sort of like, oh, okay, and had to recalibrate halfway through the film.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that if you're going to go see this movie thinking it's a female revenge, like Kill Bill. Like, if you think she's going to be, like, ripping men apart, then just check your expectations, because it's not. I was this, like, I saw it and the ending really threw me, and it was more in reflection when I was like, you know what? Because it was a case of one of those stories where things don't end the way that you expect them to.
Yeah.
And I kind of went, yeah.
Okay. I genuinely appreciated, because when that happened, I was like, where does this go
from here?
And I was kind of left hanging, and that's kind of the point of the movie.
Yeah.
And I like that in movie. I like being surprised in a movie, not sort of being getting the expected beats all the time. But I wasn't sure where I saw. I feel like I'll probably watch it again to maybe get a better sense of what
it's doing. Like, it was one of those ones that when it ended, I was, like, confused and sort of, oh, I don't know how I feel about this. And then I started thinking about it, and I started writing my review, and as I wrote, I was realizing how I was just, like, kind of praising it, and really I was like, oh, and I don't think it to me, it stayed true to who she was.
Yeah.
It was a case of she wanted a specific outcome, and she was sort of willing to do whatever and accept whatever.
Yeah.
It's very hard to talk about it because it will come out in cinemas January 7th.
We got, like, a one-off. Did you go to the one-off?
No, we had a earlier screening of it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Lucky.
I think it'll be one of those movies that will probably have, there'll be a lot more conversation about it once people see it more. You know, it might even be one of those Wonder Woman things where it's early word is good, and then it's out there for the public, and all of a sudden it's
trashed beyond belief. Oh, this whole idea of, like, the immediacy of movies coming, and then, like, I think that's the one downside to just releasing it on streaming straight away, is that it's immediately dissected and pulled apart.
And I kind of found it funny that I was like, oh, so all the people you gave the movie to watch early, and then the movie that everyone else, like, when it went out to everybody, and then all of a sudden that's when the critic rating dropped. I was like, well, there's a reason that that's happening, because I don't know how much you people are actually critics per se.
Yes. But anyway. Yes. 100%. Yeah. Unlike a lot of critics. See, and I was just thinking about this, because there's all these critics who, like, watch a movie and then they destroy it and then they go on. Whereas you will even watch movies that you don't like or didn't like the first time. You'll try to reassess things.
Mm.
And that's like, why aren't all critics doing that?
Like, yeah, I just, like, you know, I mean, there'll be some movies that I will not like, and then I try to sort of be like, you know what, this wasn't for me, but there will be an audience out there for it. Some movies I'm just like, I can't at all. But no, like, I think if we see a movie the first, like, because obviously when I'm watching it the first time, I'm dissecting it in my head, and then I'm like, but I do like to see something, if I can see it a second time before I can put my review out.
Yeah. Or even just not, like, writing your review while you're watching the movie or something
But I try to be as objective as I can. It's not always easy.
Fascinating.
But,
fascinating pick.
And number 8 is Run.
The Sarah Paulson one. Very nice. Yeah. I saw this one. I had way more fun with it than I thought I would.
Yeah.
Because it's super Hitchcocky.
Yeah.
It was just really intense and everything.
And
like
Sarah Paulson, unhinged Sarah Paulson is just the best. Oh,
for those who don't know, it's telling the story of a young girl who had a troubled birth, and she's in a wheelchair and got a host of medical things, but she slowly begins to discover that it's Munchausen's by proxy.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a spoiler to say.
No. I mean, you're very, very
this
much...
This is a bigger twist.
Yeah. You're very much tuned in that there's something not quite right with the mother, who's played by Sarah Paulson. As the movie goes on and little things are revealed, and then there's like a bigger reveal, which we won't talk about because I want people to just go. I want people to go into this movie as
blind as
possible.
Is it playing in Australia?
I don't know.
It's on Hulu.
It's on Hulu.
Because I've got my Apple TV set up to be in America, so then I watch it.
I don't actually think in Australia, if you're not like getting it from America, I don't know where it's playing. I'm assuming it'll... I wouldn't be surprised if...
It rocks up on Stan or
Amazon
something.
Amazon or Stan. I did briefly hear that they were trying to get a cinema release in Australia just because so many streaming things are getting a release in Australia, which I think is great.
I love that.
Happiest Season, Hulu, cinemas in Australia.
And that's what I thought.
Went to number one at the box office, by the way, in Australia. Good. So, yay, Australia.
Love that.
But no, I just... I
was on the edge of my seat.
And it's like 80 minutes. It's like super tight.
And I love that this is notable because it's the first time a wheelchair using actor has been cast as a wheelchair using character.
Yeah, I was like, that's
in the film.
Insane.
And she's there doing stunts and everything. Like, she's on top of the roof of the house. Yeah. I was just like, oh my God.
I was like, oh, you're not like, it's not just an actress in a wheelchair. Like, that's who you, and then her performance is incredible.
It's incredible. Incredible. So good. I loved that.
Yeah.
It was so good.
It was just a really nice little surprise.
Thriller.
Yeah.
Like, if you're a fan of like thrillers, tense thrillers.
Yeah.
My mum loved it. She loves anything about Munchausen's by proxy.
Yeah.
And she hugely loved it.
And if it's not overly violent, it's just intense. Like, it's just intense.
Yeah.
You're always sitting there going, oh, something's going to happen. Like, oh, don't do that. Oh, like when she's at the,
cinema,
the cinema, and then she goes to the pharmacy and you're
oh my God.
Yeah. Oh, I want everyone to see this movie.
Yeah. So my 10, my number 10 is a tie, and it's the only tie. I tried to avoid them, but there were just a few too many good ones. One which I know will come up later on your list, is Possessor. Written and directed by David Cronenberg, son of Cronenberg, son of David Cronenberg. And it's this sci-fi, gory, body horror thing. I've got the plot summary. So it follows an agent who works for a secretive organization that uses brain implant technology to inhabit other people's bodies, ultimately driving them to commit assassinations for high-paying clients.
That plot outline right there is enough like to be like, wow, but the movie itself.
And it does interesting things and stylistic things. I love how they do like, you know, when they do the first transfer through the body and there's like melting faces and everything. I found out they did a tremendous amount of it in camera. You know, the floating particle bit?
Yeah.
That was done practically. They sonically levitated a piece of styrofoam.
Wow. No, he's like, you're definitely David Cronenberg's son.
Because this is violent.
Oh my God. Like, I was like, I knew that this was going to be violent, but at the same time I was like, oh, this is like the opening 5 minutes alone. I was like, well, if this doesn't get an R rating, I don't know what will. And I was like, yes.
You watch Possessor Uncut?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, good. I haven't seen the other one.
Which is like, oh.
Supposedly though, the differences are the inclusion of penis. Not our future husband,
Christopher Abbott,
but the dream sequence penis.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That one's the one that they
can
cut out.
Can we please have more male nudity in cinema? Thank
you
very much.
Yes, please. Fantastic performances, super subtle, brilliantly shot. And just the violence again, like some of it is like it's excellently done for violence on film, especially the fire poker in the mouth. I was just like, no, because when the teeth bow out, I was just like nearly vomiting.
And again, it's one of those movies where you just go, you're watching it going, something really violent is about to happen, but I don't know when. And then it happens and you go, sort of knew it was coming, still wasn't prepared for it.
Yeah. And it's just a fantastic film. And this is going to be a huge cult film.
Oh, for sure.
And then tied with Possessor is another sort of violent indie, Saint Maud.
Yeah.
Written and directed by Rose Glass. Oh, did you not like this one?
No, it was one of those things where I went to see this at BIFF.
Yeah, same.
And it got about 40 minutes in. And then all of a sudden we were like, this audio is not going with the video. So we were like, what's
happening? Were you at Goma?
No, Elizabeth Picture Theatre.
Ah.
And then all of a sudden we were like, something's gone wrong. And then lights down, screen down. We're like, okay. And I sat there and we were there for like 20 minutes and I was like, I actually don't know how much longer I can sit here at a 9:30 p.m. screening.
Right.
That's now already like an hour gone, but we haven't seen an hour of the movie. Then the screen came back on and it had gone back to like, you know, it had gone back 20 minutes. Ugh. And then we were like, I don't know if I can actually speed it up or not. And then it just, the audio again, and I just went, you know what? I'm sorry. I can't actually do this.
I went and saw their second screening at Newmarket and it was great.
And then I toyed with going to see it again, but I was like, oh, I just felt so, I want to see it.
I'm so glad I switched.
I know that the ending is a bit like,
It has one of the best final edits I've seen since like All That. I don't know if you've seen All That Jazz.
Yeah.
That, you know how just phenomenal that final cut is? It's like that kind of powerful thing.
Yeah.
It follows a pious nurse who becomes dangerously obsessed with saving the soul of her dying patient.
Which is fair. Again, it was a movie that I'm sitting there going, this is tense as like it was.
Great lead performance again. Just, and it's visually, it's insane. Like she starts having these hallucinations things.
When, and
like,
you're never really sure. Yeah. Like you're like, is this actually happening or is she crazy?
Yeah. I love that kind of ambiguity. And it was just so tight and it didn't run for too long. And again, like a movie that ends that strong, like it almost doesn't matter if the rest of the movie was kind of bad because the ending is so, like, just, it's not so much a gut punch as it just, like, stabs you with a machete.
Which, like, is why I was, like, I think if the second screening wasn't so close to the screening that burned me, I probably would have gone. Yeah. But I was like, I've already got too much on my plate. I do want to see it.
I think because they were playing one of the other films that I wanted to see at the same time as that screening.
Yeah.
So then I was like, oh, well, I'll do the weekday one, you know, the weekday
one. Well, because I think Bloody Hell was the one that, and I went to like the Q&A instead of going to St. Maud. So I was like, I'll go to the other St. Maud.
Right. My number 9 is The Half of It, written and directed by Alice Wu from Netflix. This is a queer teen comedy, but it's not the kind of romantic comedy you expect, as she says in the opening dialogue. So it's when smart but cash-strapped teen Ellie Chu agrees to write a love letter for a jock she doesn't expect to become his friend or fall for his crush.
Aww.
And this is a beautiful little film. This was one of those scripts that landed on the blacklist that I've spoken about on the podcast a few times before. And
we love a blacklist script.
Yeah, they just make really good films. And I'm so happy she directed the script that she wrote
Yeah, that's always always a plus.
Yeah, and it's just, this has one of my favorite sort of editing jobs of the films from this year because it's really, it reminded me a bit of Lady Bird in the way that cutting is really intricate but not like in your face kind of, I don't know, like a Spike Lee movie or something like that. It's quite subtle, but it's doing something tangible within the texture of the story. Brilliant performances. I just love this. This is like queer excellence. This is like another one. This is another top 10 with just queer excellence and not the last one either.
Yeah.
I loved every bit of it and great performances, but great like young people performances too.
Which is always good because we like when young people are played by young people and not 30-year-olds.
So. Have you seen this one?
I haven't.
Oh, put it on your watch list because it's
really, well, I mean, good. Also like queer cinema, so
And then my number 8 is the, now I guess it's an Amazon movie, The Vast of Night. Written and directed by Andrew Patterson and also co-written with Craig W. Sanger, I believe is the name. And this is sort of like a very sort of simplified version of A Close Encounter of the Third Kind of thing, set in the 1950s.
That's pretty perfect.
And they made it for like $700,000.
Yeah.
It's set in the 1950s in small town America. And there's not a lot of plot to it, but I think, again, has these fantastic lead young performances. It's shot superbly, and there's this fantastic long take in the middle of the film that traverses the entire, have you seen it? Traverses the entire town, and I just loved it kind of going for these things that a lot of people complain about, unmotivated camera movement or whatever. I'm like, I don't give a shit, it's a cinema. You're not watching a play, watching a movie.
Like, all of these movies you're mentioning, I was like, oh, we actually had, this year was insane.
It was full of stuff. So many great movies. One of the moments in it that I thought was really well is there's this like 5-minute unbroken take of the main girl at a radio, like a phone switchboard.
Mm.
Doesn't cut, and she's just, I wanted to applaud her for that scene. I was like, that would be one of the hardest, because you're just on her, you don't hear anyone else. Oh, we hear them, but we don't see them, we don't cut to the other side of the phone.
And you're being like, that's like, you would need to know, like,
every switch hole.
You know, like, I think some people think, oh yeah, but if they, you know, if you make just a mistake, you'd be like, anyway. No, that's a very intricate.
She had to learn how. I believe I was watching an interview with her, and she had to learn how to sort of use the switchboard.
Wow, yeah,
but yeah, it just tells the story of two kids who sort of run the radio and the phone switchboard at their old 1950s town, and then strange things start happening in the night, and they have to sort of run between places in the town, and it's just very atmospheric, very cool. Yep. Not a lot of plot, but I really loved that about it, and it shot so well.
Yeah.
Shot spectacularly. So yeah, that's my 10, 9, and 8. Josh, we'll hear what his 10, 9, and 8 are right now.
The top 10, kicking off obviously with number 10, Jim Cummings, The Wolf of Snow Hollow. Yes, it's another horror movie on my list, and the first of many on my main list, but The Wolf of Snow Hollow, again, what else can I say? Again, blew me away. I dug the fuck out of this movie. It is a nice, tight, 85-minute, bloody awesome werewolf movie. I would call Goosebumps adjacent. I got definitely Goosebumps werewolf skin, if you've read that particular Goosebumps book's vibes from it, along with many others. I just... Again, Jim Cummings is the master of blending tones and sort of oddball, skewed humor and genres together, because a lot of this, I understand the criticism of like why it couldn't have worked or why it sometimes didn't work, but this just is a solid, great visual flourishes. Of course, Jim knows how to fucking move the camera, make it interesting. The performances were across the board top notch, because that completely sold the awkwardness, and him, Jim himself in the lead role, just it's magnetic, absolutely magnetic. And if you haven't heard of it, it's a bloody awesome small town werewolf movie with like great humor, great horror, violence, and just, and that's number 10 on my list, and it was just an awesome time, and I highly recommend it. Kicking off number 9 on my list is Rob Savage's Host. Now, I just talked about how great the tight runtime of Wolf of Snow Hollow was, but this Host is a very terrifying edge of a seat, 56 minutes, solid hour, and it blew everyone I know, everyone I've talked to about this, it's been blowing their minds. Like, this, what a, and I'm sorry if it isn't your director, but what a directorial debut, for at least for features. I don't know if Rob's done anything else, and I'll have to fact check myself on that later, but dude, there's fucking talent shining through across the board, from the directing, the writing, editing, performances. Performances is what makes and breaks this type of picture. And if you haven't seen it yet, it's available on Australia's Shudder, but this is all done, recorded, performed, all through webcam, like a Zoom call, because it's made right in smack dang middle of quarantine, near the sort of middle beginning, actually first sort of quarter of quarantine. And God, it's a perfect reflection of like where we are right now in terms of horror, like us being all trapped alone, facing an unknown threat, but sort of being connected virtually, but it doesn't get bogged down in the fact like the pandemic itself doesn't, like it's enough establishment of all the world we live in and reminders of the world outside world, while also completely taking us on this journey. And again, yes, it's not a horror film, and it's sort of, I said before as well, it would be a great pairing over like Skype calls, Unfriended movie from a few years back. At least I haven't seen the second one, but I did enjoy the first one. Sort of similar in tone and execution as that. This was like taken to another level in terms of this, like even like prosthetics and like stunts, and like I don't want to reveal too much away, but my God, Host, you want to be scared 56 minutes, have a laugh as well, like just plug in Host, it's a good time, not a long time either. Number 8 on my list is Autumn D. Wilde's, I'm pronouncing it right, directorial debut again. My God, lucky Emma. Full stop. Based on Jane Austen's 1815 novel of the same name. If you're not familiar with the novel, it's essentially about a well-meaning, a bit like selfish sort of young woman who like sort of madly falls in love with one of her friends. It's about, you know, this is about that sort of like adventure of love in this sort of time period, and it's like incredibly, incredibly funny. Yeah, and the movie stars like Anya Taylor-Joy, Johnny Flynn, Josh O'Connor. This, so, and like I've mentioned before, all my other movie picks so far, is just like the cast is pitch perfect for this. Like, they are nailing it 110%. And what really struck out to me about this was like not just the humor, but the way it wasn't captured like a normal comedic film, even a normal like comedic period piece or just a period piece. Like, it was had such flourish and love behind the lens and just such a keen eye for everything, and that's what made it stood out as well. It was a grand old time. Watched it, had dinner, I feel like I made dinner, watched it, sat with my friend, sat with Shane and my partner, and laughed my ass off for 2 hours. This film also stars Miranda Hart from that, everyone knows BBC's Miranda. Go check that out. That's on Stan as well. She's hilarious in this, she's hilarious in that. She's a hilarious person, awesome person. And yeah, if that doesn't get you a ticket for approval, I don't know what will, because this is a great fucking time.
And we're back. Peter, what have you got for us for 7, 6, and 5?
So 7 is never, really, sometimes, always, which I didn't know was going to be a top 10 movie. And then again, one of those ones that I reflected on and was like, this, it really, like, it stuck with me.
Yeah.
And I was like, I would never in a million years pretend to know what these characters are going through.
Yeah.
I think any male reviewer should just either not review it or be super respectful.
Yeah.
Because this is something that men could never understand. So, I mean, it's about abortion and a teenager's right to choose. And obviously the state that she's in doesn't allow it if you're under 18, but in New York it does. So it's like her and a friend
take a trip.
And I mean, you sort of read it and it goes like, reading it, you could have thought this could turn into kind of like a almost a buddy comedy.
Which I think there's another movie that came out this year called Unpregnant.
Yeah, which is basically the comedy thing. Version yeah. of this.
But this is one of those stark, realist
dramas. Like, this is like drama. Like, this is, it's again, it's like very close to being a documentary, just the way that the way it's shot. Like, everything's so close and intimate.
I've never felt more disgusted with the pay window at their work.
Gosh.
I wanted to throw up when you see what he does, like, under the thing. I just wanted, and you know that's real. You know that came from someone.
And you know that the cousin, like, you've dealt, like, you've experienced, you've probably had to do a few things.
Yeah.
That you
didn't,
And I mean, when you hear the title, the scene that the title is referenced.
I was just about to say the titular, the line.
Like,
because
you read it and go, never really, sometimes, always, like, what the hell? And you go, just when you know the scene, it's heartbreaking.
That scene.
And the fact that it never shows the lead character and it's just the doctor asking her.
Oh, you know, it's just a hold on her face.
Oh, the hold, yeah.
And
yeah,
they
yeah.
don't show the doctor asking her. That scene and then the scene from the assistant where she goes to make the report.
Yeah.
Both of those are like two of the most just uncomfortable things to sit through and necessary to sit through.
Yeah. It's, and then the lead actress, again, whose name has like completely just gone from my head.
Yeah.
What's
her name? It is. I'm just never really... Sydney Flanagan.
She has started to win a lot of the smaller Critics Circle Awards. So I would love her to be in contention because this performance this isn't a performance. Like, this is actually
real.
Like, you almost go, are you one of those people that they've hired just for this movie? Like, are you an actress?
Yeah.
And when it ended, like, I walked out going, I was depressed. Like, it's like, don't watch this movie if you want escapism.
Yeah. Pair a comedy after or something.
It's not one of those movies that you watch to enjoy per se.
Yeah.
But I guarantee, like, it'll stick with you. Like, there's no way that this movie won't have some sort of impact on you.
Yeah.
What are we up to?
Number six.
Number six. Monsoon.
Nice.
Queer cinema. Yay. Yeah. Henry Golding. Yay. again, this one just, it really took me by surprise. I had no idea what to expect. Basically, I saw it because I love Henry Golding.
Yeah.
And I just loved that it was one of those movies, again, doesn't really have a lot of plot to it.
No, I think, this is a movie that I didn't click with at all.
Okay.
I appreciate what it was and what it was doing, but I didn't click with it, like, at all.
Okay.
Because I found a lot of it, it felt to me like it was more of a short film with a lot of sort of scenery padding.
Yeah.
But I understand, like, you know, because that's that genre of film, and I rarely enjoy the plotless genre of film.
Yeah.
With a couple of exceptions.
Yeah.
But no, it's fascinating.
No, I just responded to it. Like I don't really know why.
I loved the opening shot above the street. I just found that hypnotic.
I don't know. Like, it could be because
Henry Golding.
beautiful, but I don't know. Like, maybe because I know, like, my partner and I know, like, the culture.
Right.
I think that could have affected how I looked at it, because I think it's one of those things where it's difficult if you're, you know, gay and of that culture.
Yeah.
But no, I just really got immersed in it. I just was like,
I'm
really
happy
to just sit here and watch him go about his day.
Walk around the place.
Meeting a beautiful men and everything. So yeah. No, it was a nice little surprise.
I'm glad it got a release here too.
Yeah. Because I saw it with the Rainbow Celebration.
Right.
And then Mad Men gave it a little release, and I'm like, good for you, Mad Men. Doing God's work.
Awesome.
And number five is Soul.
Nice.
Yeah.
This is Pixar's.
This is Pixar's latest movie, which I'm so angry it didn't get a cinema release.
Yeah, that would have played really
well.
I feel like it's not going to make as big of a splash.
No,
because it's not in the cinema.
No, and I think it's one of those movies that feels very relevant for 2020.
Beautifully,
like, really reflecting on what you've got with your life and what you should do, and that no day is guaranteed. Visually, this movie was
one of their best ones. Stunning. Just some of the lighting, like, there's some scenes where I was like, I could take a photo of this and it looks photorealistic,
like,
but it doesn't feel weird having an animated character who's exaggerated in the Pixar style in the middle of it. Like, it worked and I was shocked.
Like, the thing, the scene where they're, like, cutting his hair and there's just, like, the strands of his hair. I'm like, that is detailed.
Yeah.
And again, like, if you've, hopefully you've seen this movie.
Yes.
It's on Disney Plus. But I loved that, like, the trailers were literally the first 20 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
And then, I'm not going to spoil it, but, like, something happens and I was like, this movie just turned into kind of more of a traditional animated movie with the team up of Jamie Foxx and Tina
Buddy
Fey,
the buddy comedy thing
when it's on Earth. But again, it was, like, super serious. Then it became really funny, and then it became really super,
I just was
like, of course, Pixar, you know, breaking your heart all over again because they can't possibly not do that.
I feel like the whole thing about, like, don't just be obsessed with the thing you do that is not your purpose in life. And I'm like, I feel like they're trying to tell me something and I don't want to listen, but I feel like I should, but I don't want to listen to them at all.
And like Jamie Foxx is great, but to me, I was like, Tina Fey was just amazing.
Yeah.
Little 22.
I almost didn't, because I was like, who voiced this? I wasn't trying to check
it. I think if you know it's her, you go, oh, it's her.
Yeah.
If you don't know it's her, you sort of, like, you part of me that goes, like, Amy Poehler. Is it, like, you go, it's definitely like a comedy actress.
Yeah.
But then you've got, like, Graham Norton.
Unexpectedly fantastic.
Rachel House, who, if people don't know, is from Hunt for the Wilder People.
Yes, I knew that. I was like, I feel like this is her.
They keep her, you know, she's speaking in her New Zealand accent. Her character is
Richard Ayoade.
It's just like all these little people that are in these really bizarre characters.
The design of those characters too is really cool. They're like line art.
Yeah, it's kind of like 2D, but it's not 2D.
Yeah.
No, I just thought that like it was visually beautiful. I think it really speaks to people more so now.
Yeah.
Because of everything that's happened in 2020.
And we've had to reassess our lives.
I think that's it. It didn't emotionally ruin me as much as I was expecting. Because to me I was like Inside Out is still...
See, Up did it for me. Inside Out didn't do it as much for me. And Soul for me is sort of on par with Inside Out for me.
Because I was sort of all prepared. I was like, yep, okay, cool. Because I've shed a few tears in cinemas this year. I won't lie.
Okay.
There's been a few times that I was like...
I shed tears at home with some of these, with my number three.
I was like, God damn it. But no, so this one didn't quite get to me, but it's still just a beautiful, beautiful movie that I really, really wish got a cinema release, but I understand...
Maybe they'll do some retrospective screenings that might be worth seeing.
But I understand the notion of going to Disney Cinema, Plus because, you know, but...
What are you
going to
do?
But proof that animated movies aren't always for kids.
No. I definitely was watching that feeling like, I don't think kids would get this at all or even laugh at the humor.
No, like, it was very much, I was like, this is just an adult movie with animation.
Yeah. So my number 7 pick is the aforementioned Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn.
Yay!
I had such a blast with this one and I didn't expect to, but because... I wanted to support female filmmakers. I wanted to support sort of the way Margot Robbie had went and put this together, intentionally being like, we're going to have women run the show.
Yeah.
And I got... The one thing I can say about this that I rarely hear people say is the action scenes in it gave me that feeling of sort of the type of action scenes we haven't seen since the McGee Charlie's Angels.
Underrated, by the way.
Severely underrated. At least the first one. Although the second one's not too bad.
I have a lot of fun with the second one.
But that action style where it's really fun and it's referencing some of the more sort of Eastern styles, but it's not full-blown wire work, like a Tarantino kind of thing or something like that. It is just this... the scene where she takes the cocaine and then starts batting everyone. I was just like, this is great action. This
run, Piggy, run.
Yeah. Great villains. I loved Chris Messina and Ewan McGregor in this.
And I was like, this is a movie that also isn't afraid to, like, the scene where the family's hanging upside down.
Yeah.
And he's just like, cut their faces off. And you're there's a little chart. And he's like, oh, you're going to. Like, it was really just unapologetic. It was like, this is what people do.
Yeah.
Ewan McGregor, who I love that he was very much on the spectrum of like, is he gay? Is he not gay? Because you sort of, him and Chris Messina, I was like, I wouldn't be surprised if that was something there. I liked that ambiguity.
I liked the ambiguity and I liked, there's like a reading of it that said, oh, it's not that he's gay. Chris Messina is, he's not. And he's sort of collected this kind of personality the way he collects everything else in his thing because it's fashionable.
Yeah.
And I found that even more insidious. It's sort of a nice read.
Because Ewan McGregor kind of comes off like he would be like, if I have to be gay to get what I want, I would be.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But I just had so much fun with this. I saw it twice on cinemas. This was the last film I saw in a cinema before we then had the break from because I watched it a second time in cinemas. I watched one of my upcoming ones. My number 4 film was also I watched them back to back in a cinema when I was in Western Australia for a film festival.
Nice.
But you know, I loved it. More superhero movies like that, please. Number 6 is The 40-Year-Old Version. On Netflix, written and directed and starring Rada Blank, and it covers the story. Oh, I should probably get to the story of it. It is Rada is a down on her luck New York playwright who is desperate for a breakthrough before 40, reinventing herself as rapper Rodimus Prime. She vacillates between the world of hip-hop and theatre in order to find her true voice. I didn't expect... I hadn't heard about this film, but this won one of the Sundance Awards. Rada Blank, she wrote, directed, produced, starred in, and she's just a fucking powerhouse in this film. She's funny as hell. really talented. There's these really great raps, and I'm so glad she does this sort of rap called Poverty Porn, where she's sort of decrying... Have you seen this one?
No, not yet.
Oh, she's decrying the way that, like, white people only like black stories when it's, like, poverty porn, when you're watching black people, like, suffering in the poverty, and there's this whole arc where she has to write this play for this, like, rich white guy, and it's the play that comes out of it is just bad in the way that, you're laughing along with the joke and just how, like... It's really funny, really brilliant, and I'm so glad they're submitting Poverty Porn to the Academy for Best Original Song. I'm so happy about that. This is one of those great lead performances. The fact that she directed this too, it's shot in this gorgeous black and white widescreen anamorphic thing, and there's a fantastic supporting performance that's never going to get talked about in the way from Peter Kim, who I'd never heard of before.
Mm.
And he plays sort of her gay agent or manager, and he's sassy and brilliant and funny. And I was just like, where have all these people been? I want to see everything they do. And she's sort of winning all these like breakthrough artist awards. And she's like, I'm nearly 40 and I'm finally, you know, it's weird art imitating life, because part of the story is she won this like great playwrights under 30. And then that's all she's done until she sort of gets to sort of figure out what she's going to do. But it's on Netflix worldwide. Cannot recommend it enough. I just had it's feel good, but not in the like a hard sort of adrenaline shot of joy. It just, you watch it and you feel like you've had like a really great meal, like your nutrients, and you've had fun with the flavors and everything like that. It's just perfectly made.
Yeah,
highly recommend it. And then my number five is The Invisible Man, written and directed by Lee Whannell, which I assume is going to maybe show.
It's not in my top 10. It was one of those ones that it would have been. It's just this year has, I think all these like smaller films have really come out. But I mean, Invisible
Man.
This
is the most studio film I have pretty much on my list, unless you count the Netflix ones.
But
this is sort of a retelling of The Invisible Man from the point of view of a woman being pursued by an ex who everyone, like an abusive ex who everyone thinks is dead, and she's trying to prove that he's someone she can't see. I love this. This played gangbusters with the audience that I went and saw it with. There is a scene smack bang in the middle that got just an audible
restaurant
scene that gets an audible gasp every time this plays in front of people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is like top three scenes of the year, just in terms of impact on an audience, and with a crowded house too. It was so fun. I saw this with my partner, and my partner doesn't react big to things, unlike me. I react massively to movies and stuff like that, and he gasped and jaw on the floor, and that, like, you don't get sounds like that from him
normally,
and he adored this. It was so good and so fun, and give Lee Whannell an unlimited budget.
You look at this, like, it was a $7 million movie
shot in Australia.
Like, you look at it and just go, like, it looks like it's 10 times that, you know. And I would, like, I agree that this is a movie that an audience, it's definitely an audience movie, because I saw this, I mean, I saw it very early because I was speaking to Lee Whannell, so I got to see it, and it was literally me and like two other people in the cinema, and I was like, I feel like I can't make any noise because, you know, and then I went to see it again, and it was the full audience, and I'm glad that that audience stayed quiet when you needed to stay quiet,
because
silence is utilized so well in that movie.
I hate and loved how, like, basically from the get-go, you put on the title, The Invisible Man, and then you have this camera, like, moving without anything in the frame, and now you're looking in the frame for something to happen, and then for the whole movie.
She hits the bloody dog bowl, and it scares the crap out of you.
Yes.
Like, this one... I honestly think, I don't think people were expecting this to be
as good as it was.
Yeah. I think, like, Invisible Man from the guy that did, like, wrote Saw. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And I love that they've, because he was very much like, if we're making Invisible Man, he's like, we're doing it from the point of his victim.
Although,
we're not making this the Invisible Man where he's the main character.
Yeah.
You know, and I love that they did that
and
made her, like, who we're behind. And the whole movie, you're just like, she's telling the truth.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Elizabeth Moss, my God.
Yeah. So that's my 7, 6, and 5. We'll hear... Josh, what's your 7, 6, and 5?
All right, and I'm back again. And leading with number 7 is Brian Duffield's Spontaneous. Another fucking directorial debut on my list. And I'm happy to be fact-checked on some of the previous ones, but I know this for a fact. Brian motherfucking Duffield, you creative genius. This film, starring Australia's own Catherine Lanford and Charlie Plummer as the leads, and a plethora of other, like, teens from multiple movies, and not really teens, they're playing teens, but, you know, this is a film nailing it down on the head. It's a love story, but with explosions. A lot of kids exploding. And I do know it's based on a book. I cannot remember the author's name, but this adaptation is, again, like Brian Duffield's many other scripts, just tonally tightrope rock. It's and that's of tone, just of style. Like, it he's like his other scripts, I'm in love with this one. I cannot wait to read his annotated notes, because apparently he's making a book. But this film is so sweet and perhaps horrific and sad and longing, but such a beautiful film for, like, 2020 as well. Because I know this film got delayed. It got made a few years ago and then got delayed and pushed back. But you don't see that. You don't feel like... Because, and in fact, in my opinion, 2020 is, like, sort of... There's definitely that sort of war and border between, like, pre-2020 and post-2020. But this has fit right in and was such a beautiful reflection of today, the last few years, and boost for the future as well. Like, and that's what's so beautiful about it. By also just being a great, tight teen comedy with exploding kids. Even though these are ranked, I don't feel like these rankings are set in stone. Like, I'll move these around and add more, definitely, because I'm definitely missing out on so many other films, like His House, if I said it right, Run, for another example. There's so much I still haven't seen. But and moving on to number 6, which is Palm Springs, directed by Max Barbico, which I hope I pronounced it right, starring Andy Samberg and Kristen Milioti. This was released, I believe, earlier this year in America, like near the beginning of the pandemic, but us in Australia only got it like a month and a half ago, and I was immensely excited for this. I was like, it's another sort of, you don't know what the premise of this movie is, it's sort of like a Groundhog Day sort of skewed sort of comedy, but I was so excited for this, and my expectations were met. I loved this movie, not only for the performances, just for the comedy. The directing is like not even surprising, but just top notch. Again, like, I'm just so in love and gushing about all these movies on my list, and it's hard to even, like, articulate a coherent thought, right? But just word vomiting, this is my love and passion for these movies, because they are just been such a great escape from this year, and every single one is such a special place in my heart. But this movie is really good, and in my opinion, I enjoyed this more than Groundhog Day. I thought the sort of execution of the sort of science fiction element of it, and the emotional core of the movie just works so well, and Andy Samberg and Kristen Milioti, but Andy Samberg, fucking top-notch performance and balance of, like, this is, like, sort of skewing to what he usually plays, cheekiness of it, but he brings so much more depth to it as well, and I'm just so happy to see it, because I want to see more of him doing more of this sort of thing as well. Yeah, the Palm Springs, I don't want to spoil anything or elaborate on it too much. If you've seen the trailer, it's on Amazon Prime, so if you've seen the trailer, it's actually decently non-spoilery, and you just go in, or don't even watch the trailer, it's just know this is like a more modern Groundhog Day-esque comedy with, in my opinion, a bit more depth, a bit more charm, and a greater payoff. We're halfway there with number 5, and this film, my god, so good, I had to see it twice in the cinema, and it was one of the very last films I saw pre-COVID, and that is Birds of Prey, parentheses, and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn, close parentheses. Holy fuck, this is a superhero film that will stick in the minds, at least in my mind, and all our gay hearts for many years to come, because what a fucking roller coaster of awesomeness this was, and that's... let's put that on the fucking poster. Kathy Young, you are awesome and fabulous, and your direction was top-notch again, and top-notch is the key fucking phrase I'm using for most of my films, because that, I believe, is accurate. So yeah, this is sort of DC's... another entry into the DC sort of movie universe, because now that's what they're calling it. They're skewing it off in many different ways. This is sort of a pseudo, sort of like soft sequel to Suicide Squad, it doesn't sort of directly contradict anything, but my God, does it improve upon everything to do with Harley Quinn. And that's just thanks to Margot Robbie's sort of involvement as a producer, and I believe as a co-writer, or at least involved in the writing process. And she was never the issue with Harley Quinn in the first place. She nailed that, but I just love to see her take that character, whom she, like, loves so much, and, like, really develop it properly. And, like, it's her baby, and it's her world, and she's kick-ass at it. This other cast, oh my God, dare I mention Ewan fucking McGregor, just my dear crush of life, Ewan McGregor, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, and my other, like, fucking child of the cross, Junie Smollett. I godly hope I pronounced her last name correctly, even her first name. I'm so sorry if I didn't. Rosie Perez and, like, Chris Mancina rocking that fucking bleach blonde look and being creepy as fuck. So, yeah, anyway, this film and cast, everything is such huge improvement upon Suicide Squad and upon most of the entries into the DC Universe. This is top tier for me. This is, like, what's leading the run of DC films for me, and for superhero films over the last few years. Like, I went into this quite excited, because I was like, I knew. Like, I was like, oh, Margot Robbie's producing as a female director. It seems to be, like, not contradicting anything, but seems to be really selling a particular tone and style, and it delivered, like, to the max. It delivered to the max, and it is such a great, simple story, but executed with so much visual flourish, like, beautiful, goddamn gorgeous scene transitions, amazing fight choreography, the heroes in the film, and, like, which are all, you know, obviously women, and, like, they all have agency, and they all have their own motivations, and it all, like, sort of pays off in this beautiful, rich way. And it's under 2 hours as well, which is another fucking tick for a superhero movie as well. It gets it wrapped up neatly. And I say neatly, which is funny, because the movie is anything but neat in terms of just style. But yeah, if you haven't seen this, and if you're, like, a bit unsure about DC films, like, honestly, it's like, start with this, and you are gonna go downhill, but, like, you'll still always have this, and I'm happy to say I'm excited to see what comes next from Kathy Yan, both involved with DC, but also outside of it.
Very nice. I will find out what they are, again, once I edit this together. So we're getting nearly to the end of the list. So 4, 3, and 2. Peter, what is your pick?
So my number 4 pick is, I don't know how many people have seen this movie or heard of it. It's called Cicada.
Yes, yes. You told me about this one.
Yeah, it's, again, queer cinema.
Yeah.
It's a New York love story that toes the line between narrative and documentary, with two actors reliving parts of their own experiences. And you can very much tell that this is a personal film.
Deeply personal
film. And I get, like, the documentary thing, I was like, it's very close to being a documentary. But, I mean, you've obviously got, there's little additives, like you've got Kobe Smulders as this therapist who is just the worst therapist, because it's all very, like,
oh, God, yeah.
She's, like, she doesn't give a shit about what he's saying. She's, like, you know. But this movie, I was like, this movie to gay men, this movie will resonate. It's like the way that he's kind of promiscuous, and it's very easy to do that. But then
being intimate is where he struggles.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you realize why he struggles, and you're like, oh, like the whole movie, you just like, there's something here. Yeah. There's something going on with this guy. And then all throughout it, you hear this sort of news reports of, I don't really know if I should say it, because I don't know how many people are going to see this movie.
Yeah.
But you hear news reports of a particular sexual abuse case, and it's, you know, you're sort of thinking, okay, that there's a reason that this is kind of the only ambient sound that we're hearing from TV in certain scenes. And then, like, the person that he hooks up with has their own sort of PTSD from being attacked because of being a black man.
Yeah.
And really has nothing to do with his sexuality. It's purely race, which is horrifying. So you just got these two, like, incredibly broken people who find each other, and there's like this beautiful little love story, but they're just like self-sabotaging half the time, you know, which is also, again, something that gay men can very much relate to.
And wonderfully frank sex scenes, I thought. Yeah. As well. And sex scenes that aren't like perfectly sexual as well.
Which is like, that's what sex is. Like, yeah. I don't know anybody who's just like, oh, we had perfectly lit sex. And, you know, like everything went the way it was. Like, no, this is messy figuring out your rhythm with this other person. Yeah. I knew nothing about this movie. I saw it through the Queer Screen Festival.
Same. So when you told me about it, I was like, yes, okay.
Beautiful movie. And the two main actors are just like,
yeah. And the main character, he wrote and directed it, yeah, as well.
Matthew Pfeiffer, I think.
Yes. Yeah. And then he took a lot of the plot about the other character from stuff that the actor had told him about his life. Yeah. So then he put that on.
Yeah, because I then sort of started digging into the co-star and sort of found out how.
Oh, of course.
Of course I did. He's a beautiful black man. Why wouldn't I? And found out just how how personal this was. So, yeah. My number three. Is that what we're up to?
Yes.
Number three, Sound of Metal.
Okay, interesting.
I just the
Riz Ahmed vehicle about a metal drummer who starts to go deaf.
So when I watched it, I was like, oh no, the subtitles are a deliberate thing. They've made this movie so that deaf people can watch it all the way through. Riz Ahmed is, I was like, if he's not in the actor race, then I think there's something inherently
he's
wrong.
Very good.
He's so good. It's one of those things. I don't know why I responded to it as much as I do.
I didn't respond to it the same way. I think a lot of people, I think I was just wanting them to, I think because I was writing something about a deaf guy years and years ago, and my sort of initial plan for, I'm not going through with it.
Yeah.
My initial plan for it was to basically be exclusively from his point of view. So all your sound mix. So you would either knock out the sound completely or it would be muffled or whatever he's going to be hearing.
Yeah.
And I wanted this film to do that 100% of the time.
Okay, yeah.
And I understand why it didn't, because there's only so much an audience will tolerate of that.
I think it was very much like, we'll be as experimental as we can for a mainstream audience because we still need that mainstream money for everywhere. But I loved the change in when it's like it's from his perspective and then it immediately cuts to what everyone else is hearing.
Yeah.
I thought the scenes with him and I think it's the guy Paul Fauci.
I hope he's getting
buzz that I'm like, absolutely. Like, I saw that movie and was like, okay, Riz Ahmed, pretty much guaranteed. I was like, we definitely need to be talking about this guy, the guy that plays his
mentor.
Yeah. At the deaf camp. And even Olivia Cook.
She's so good.
Like, she doesn't really have too much to do, but she elevates a very thinly written part and makes it her own.
Yeah.
And you can just see the love that she has for Riz Ahmed's character. And she's like, I just want you to be better, like to get better. And you need to focus on you. And I need to not be selfish and let you do that. And, you know, she's like, there's a lot of backstory going on with her.
Yeah.
You know, and I like that there's like just these little hints that, you know, she's self-destructive and self-abusive. And he's kind of saved her a little bit, you know.
It's streaming on Amazon Prime, by the way.
Yes. So there it is available.
Worldwide available.
Yep.
And definitely recommend it. It has very Star Is Born vibes in terms of the visuals. I definitely
like
felt kind, that way.
Yeah, a little bit pale, sort of, I guess. Yeah. It will never get a Star Is Born reaction.
No, sadly.
It will. And I'm glad to see Riz Ahmed in a lead role in a worthy project.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like he came out like Nightcrawler, he came out and we were like, okay.
Yeah.
There's something about this guy. I mean, we're all like, it's Jake Gyllenhaal, so obviously you've got a lot
Focusing on him.
And then, you know, it was like,
he did The Night Of is the thing that broke him out and he won Emmys for it. And then finally they cast him in, you know, the Star Wars thing.
And then Venom, and he was getting all of these, I mean, typical big budget movies that you would do as like an actor on the rise, you take all the big stuff.
Yeah.
And hopefully this will be like his chance to show that I'm a lead actor.
I'm a capital A actor.
I'm, you know, and he's beautiful to look at. So.
Shirtless quite a lot in this film too.
Yeah. Oh, damn.
And your number two?
My number two, you have mentioned, it is Possessor.
Yeah. Nice.
It's so good.
The second I finished it, I'm like, I have to rewatch this film very soon.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
I had a screener on to watch it, so I could only sort of see it the once. And it really stuck with me. And then I know that we got it in cinemas here, and I really wanted to see it again. I just never got to it.
So late in like one session. It was a kind day, of like this, yeah.
But I've found it on 4K, and I'm Blu-ray, like, I'm really tempted to buy it because I think that'll look amazing in 4K.
Some of those, I love how he does the shots of the city, and he like, they start rolling in a way. I was like, oh, this is how you use B-roll footage. I've never seen B-roll footage shot like this.
Yeah, and the poster image of Andrew Riseborough's face just being melting.
As a mask.
And I was like, okay. Oh. And then that scene is in the movie.
Yeah.
And why it's happening, you just go, oh.
It has, for my money, the scariest, most unnerving, scary sequence in a movie this year, which is the pulse test scene. That got me so, like,
ugh. Like, yeah, we can't stress enough that if you're, like, if you wince or if you're adverse to
violence, this is not your
film. Don't watch it. I mean, the story, it's an amazing science fiction story. It's an amazing horror movie. It's an amazing thriller. It's even like a really, like a relationship drama. Like there's a lot of stuff going on, but it is insanely violent.
Yeah.
So if you've got a weak stomach, just, you know, and it's not like you can watch, like you can turn away because the scenes, they're extended scenes of violence, you know.
Yeah.
But again, it's not violence for the sake of just being violent. Like it feels necessary.
Yeah.
It's Cronenberg, so he's always going to embellish.
Yeah.
I
want to see his other film. He did something called Antiviral, which now I want to go and hunt down and see after seeing Possessor.
Possessor's much better.
Oh, okay, right.
But Antiviral, you watch it and go, okay, I can see this. Okay, cool.
Okay.
Just blew me away, this movie.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. This is the thing, is that like all of my honorable mentions and my top 10 are basically on par with each other. Like these aren't ranked in terms of quality for me, really.
It is very, like, I was looking at it going, apart from, like, it's up there towards maybe like the 8, 9, 10s where I was like, these would never be number ones.
Yeah.
But movies that I didn't even mention as honorable mentions, I was like, there was so much good stuff this year. Like, I don't want people thinking because we didn't get big blockbuster movies that this year was a write-off, because it wasn't.
It absolutely,
you know,
wasn't.
Like, you'll probably be listening to this and going, I've never heard of half these movies, and be like, that's the point.
Go and seek them out because they're really good.
You know?
My number four pick is Emma. This was a movie I wasn't expecting, like, because I'm not a big Jane Austen.
I debated with this one about whether to, oh my God.
I'm not a big Jane Austen fan.
Yeah.
But I'd heard good reviews or something like that, and I went and saw it when I was in Perth. I was like, because I was between screenings, and I was literally, my hotel was right next to a cinema, so I was just like,
might as well.
I'd already seen the city like the day before, so I was like, okay, I'll go see Emma, and then I'll go see Birds of Prey.
Yeah,
and Emma was just,
was that the double feature?
Yeah, that was my double feature.
Oh my God, so good.
Absolute joy. Directed by Autumn de Wilde and written by Eleanor Cotton. And Autumn de Wilde, she never directed a film before. She'd done some music video stuff, and now this is her first feature film.
Like, this is a movie that, like, you look at it and go, oh, this actress, this director's probably done, like, you know, 10 movies or something. No,
yeah,
like,
she's fantastic.
So beautiful to look at.
So good. It stars the fantastic,
Anya Taylor-Joy,
who also did a really great job in The Queen's Gambit. That was a great thing from this year. But and it's just Emma, but it's maybe one of the best Jane Austen's ever made.
Yeah. And, like, it's one of those movies where you just go, even if you hear it and just go, oh, Jane Austen, be like, no. It's
funny.
It is
deeply funny.
I was not expecting it to be as funny as it was. Because I remember seeing the trailers going, okay, it kind of looks a bit quirky. And also I was like, Anya Taylor-Joy has a certain quality about her. It was like, she can be unlikable. Like, you look at her and just go, is this like Emma, but she's like super, super bitchy.
Yeah.
And, you know, the character does some very...
Because she's not a good... She's not a good character. She's not nice. She's selfish.
Like, yeah. And Anya Taylor-Joy...
doesn't shy away from
it. No. So I was a bit like, oh, I wonder if it's going to be Emma, but, like, you know, not the Emma that we're expecting.
Not trying to make everyone
But she's
look
actually,
beautiful.
Like, she's so good in this.
Yeah. And all the supporting roles. And Miranda Hart.
Oh, Miranda Hart.
And she has one of the best moments in this film that really that just, movie, like, that, sucks the breath out of that, you unexpectedly.
That was one of those scenes where the reaction in the cinema when she says the line.
Yeah.
And you see Miranda Hart's face. And it was, everyone in the cinema was just like.
What's wild is the movie gets you behaving like you were in those times where a line, because nowadays someone says that, it's going to be like, whatever, fuck you.
Yeah.
But it got you to the point where you were scandalized by it. And I just loved it.
Miranda Hart is.
The perfect casting choice for that.
She is one of the most, like, likable people.
Yeah.
Like, if you haven't seen the show Miranda. It's on Stan.
It's one of the best shows.
It's one of the best classical sitcoms ever made. Like, it's hilarious. And she embodies that character so well in Emma. Yeah. Like, she's just like, she's so happy and cheerful. Yeah. And like, and that's why the line is like, it breaks you.
Yeah. The love interest actor was very swoon worthy.
Yeah.
And they played all those like intense romance, non-touching scenes so well. You just felt it. And Josh O'Connor as well.
Oh,
showing up. So just he gives a grin and you're cacking yourself.
And also like, and you go, Josh O'Connor, like the God's own country, Josh O'Connor.
Yeah.
And he's so funny. And this whole like Bill Nye.
Yeah.
Who's just like, deadpan.
The draft. Oh, there's a draft there. Send the.
It really is like.
It's such a good movie.
It's like it doesn't deserve to be as good as it is.
No. You know? And I saw that one back in March, and it's been in the top of my top 10 basically since then. And my number three.
All these movies.
Yeah, it's so good. My number three is the Netflix animated feature Over the Moon.
Oh, okay.
Which. I'd heard like good things about it, and it sort of tells the story of a Chinese girl and all that kind of thing. So I was like, I'm here for some interesting, diverse animated things, and as you know, as opposed to some of these other white people driven diversity tales.
Yeah.
And I wasn't expecting to bawl my eyes out, and I did. I didn't know it was a musical until it started. It has these fantastic musical numbers. I'm like, yes.
Oh, cool.
So it's directed by Glenn Keane and co-directed by John Cars, written by Audrey Wells, with additional dialogue by Jennifer Yee McDevitt and Alice Wu, who did the half of it from earlier in my list. So I'm really, like, you know, I didn't realize that until I was sort of writing the list. I'm like, oh, Alice Wu had
input on script. Okay.
But it tells the story of a young girl who builds a rocket to the moon to blast off, hoping to meet a mythical moon goddess to try and prove her existence to her family who doesn't believe her. And I won't tell you more than that because it does quite a really good job. And it has a brilliant sort of Up-esque opening sequence. And there is a musical number.
Is that why you cried?
I cried because of the end, because the end was just so beautiful.
Okay, cool.
Sort of the way I cried, like, in Paddington at the end, Paddington 2, the movie that we'll destroy.
Please get a Paddington 3, by the way.
Oh, yes. And someone suggested...
Florence Pugh.
Florence Pugh is the villain.
And I was like, yes.
I'm there for...
That's a thing.
But no, with Over the Moon, there's this... What's interesting is that narratively, it jumps kind of into a lot of different things, and they all gel well together in a way. I think maybe some people don't necessarily like that. They want a more streamlined American thing, but it definitely felt like it was drawing from the culture that it was about.
Okay.
But there is the moon goddess. She goes up to meet the moon goddess, and the moon goddess has her big introductory pop smash number. And
awesome.
It is, I have no idea why this isn't as big as an Ariana Grande number. It is so perfect
and
brilliant. And visually, just the way they animated this, it's visually astounding work.
Okay.
Because she goes to the moon and they do their own vision of the moon.
Yeah.
And it's great. I cannot rave about this movie enough. And it has one of my favorite sort of animal companions of recent memory that even has their own arc in it. Like, as opposed to just being the silly jokes or the reaction shot, although there are some just phenomenal reaction shots of a rabbit. It's so good. But has their own arc too.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I cried at the end. It was beautiful and stunning. And I really wish I could see that on a cinema. I'm not going to get to. I want a DVD of it. I want special features. I'm not going to get any of that because it's a Netflix movie. But I'm glad that it exists.
Don't get me and it's from an old, physical media.
I think it's from an old Disney animator.
Okay.
Maybe I think not a disgruntled Disney animator, but certainly a Disney animator who wanted to kind of branch out those things.
Get out of the Disney brand. Bubble, yeah.
And I cannot recommend it enough. Have you seen it?
I haven't, no.
Watch it. It's beautiful. Okay. I liked it more than I like Soul.
Okay. Well, I feel like Big pop numbers in Ariana Grande. I'm like, come on.
Yeah. It's called, what's the number? It's I am your, like illuminated or illumination or something like okay. that. Cause she's the moon goddess. Yeah. She lights up the moon and it's so beautiful.
Cool.
And then my number two pick is also from Netflix and it is His House.
Oh yeah.
Which is the horror film about, a couple from, I want to say it's Sudan. I did write this down. A refugee couple making a harrowing escape from war-torn South Sudan, but then they struggle to adjust to their new life in an English town that has an evil lurking beneath the surface. They're in sort of this community housing, and there's something in the walls that's haunting them.
Oh,
did you see this?
There's so many movies. My God.
Have you seen this one?
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh,
unsettling
and one of the best horrors. It left me. This was like for a long time, my number one was there, and this is the only one that came close to being like, my number one, I do count as my number one.
Yeah, yeah.
Ranked wise, and then everything else is sort of just below. Just but his right, house yeah. came the closest to hitting this.
Yeah.
Because it's not a horror film in the blah, blah, scary movie, great plot. You know, like, it's definitely an atmospheric
which
thing.
I think is why people a lot of people complain, because I was like, if I want a horror movie, where's my serial killer in a mask and blood and gore,
and it's not there's not a lot of levity in this one as which I guess I understand, but there's levity in other things. Like
it's like sometimes
you don't want it.
Sometimes
this is
a horror movie just needs to be a horror movie.
This is definitely in the Hereditary brand of horror where it's quite intense all the time, and there's some phenomenal scenes. Some of the most intense scenes have nothing to do with the supernatural presence that is haunting them.
Okay.
Although that stuff I found really compelling. It's visually astounding. I cannot believe this is a first film because it's shot with the expertise of someone with like decades under their belt, just like Emma. You're like, this is someone with decades under their damn belt.
Yeah.
And they're pulling this off. And there's this phenomenal dinner table sequence that then turns into an ocean, and just the performances, the lead actress who's, I would butcher the name if I pronounce it, cause I'm very, very, ineloquent. But both the performances, but I definitely found hers cause Wunmi Musaku is her name, and Sope Dirisu, I hope I'm pronouncing those correctly, play the main couple. And the woman, she has this different reaction to the suits because the supernatural presence is more so going after the man. And then she comes in, she has this great line where she's like, after all the shit you've seen, do you think a ghost is scary?
Yeah.
Like, and there's this horrendous, I won't spoil this one, there's a horrendously unnerving scene set in like a community hall during sort of a dream sequence that just destroys you.
Okay.
And it's phenomenally well shot, but it's really like, I cannot say enough good. And Matt Smith is in it presumably as he then gets the budget because he's in a tiny little supporting role as sort of the minder of the couple, you know, the government person to oversee their stay.
You imagine at least they would have been like, well, we've got a not a name, but we've got someone who at least will, we can get a bit of backing for this.
But it feels like it was made on like $20-30 million. It's so good and unnerving and unsettling and important viewing, especially in Britain where their racism is on the rise. I cannot recommend it enough. It's on streaming on Netflix worldwide. Yep. Go watch it now, immediately. Josh, what are your 4, 3, and 2?
We're on the home stretch now, and at number 4, one of my favorite films of the year, Freaky, directed by Christopher Landon, whom you may know as the director of Happy Death Day, both parts 1 and 2, or Happy Death Day to you. This film, oh my god, again, this came out in Australia, I think, actually, sorry, globally, like, only a month or two ago, or a month and a half ago. This was fucking awesome to see. Catherine Newton, Vince Vaughn, all the other cast, like, top-notch again. All the films on my list, I've been so impressed with all the casting in terms of, like, how they fit within their roles and break against the type of roles they play. And just in saying that, Vince Vaughn really fucking breaks type in this and really goes to bat in terms of, and I guess I should say why, is because this is not only a slasher movie, like a comedic slasher movie, but it is a body switch movie. If you don't know, this was originally called Freaky Friday the 13th. You know, a play on both Friday the 13th, it's a slasher, and Freaky Friday. That's been remade like a dozen times, but yeah, now shortened to Freaky. This is like, so essentially a killer packing a young girl with a sort of mystical object and end up swapping bodies. So the rest of the film plays out with the teenage girl soul inside Vince Vaughn's body and the killer's soul inside the teenage girl's body. And this is done so fucking well in terms of like horror, suspense, laughs, just everything, an actual genuine heart and earnestness. This film is so earnest and so sweet at times and horrific and brutal. Some of my favorite representation and just some of my favorite executions of just like scenes, casting. Yeah, this is definitely had to, this instantly slot like the opening 2 minutes, 5 minutes, like instantly slotted this film into my top of the year, and I'm so happy for it. And I really hope Christopher Landon does plays around in this world more, and in the Happy Death Day world, and maybe a crossover world, and just in general what he does next, because he's one of my favorite directors, and he's a queer director, and he's such an inspiring person and director right now, and I'm so happy, and just making me gush again. But this film was so much fun. And yeah, it's another horror on my list. Like, most of my lists so far has been either horror or comedy adjacent. Of course, they're the two sides of the same coin. But this one is the blending of both. And it's easy for this to go wrong. But this, like, again, another type rope walk, kind of like spontaneous. And the writer of this film, I give him so much credit for that too. I think his name is Michael Kennedy. I believe it for him. Michael Kennedy. And some of the stories I know about his process of writing this and the sort of what he embedded in it for his personal life is just so heartening, and like, he did such an amazing job, and I just want to give him credit as well because the writing is stellar. Yeah, this is one I'll be picking up and watching again and again and again and again. And coming in at number 3 is Gretel and Hansel, directed by Oz Perkins, whom you guys don't know is the lovable tall guy from Legally Blonde who helps Elle reach the top of the shelf, and she helps some ladies. They don't deserve him because he's too sweet. You don't know as well, he is Anthony Perkins, aka Norman Bates' son. And yeah, he's a sort of established sort of indie horror director. Out of the two of his films I've seen, this is like, in my opinion, so good. I was not a fan of I'm the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House. That may never be the title because I just drove it from my memory. It was so not my cup of tea, but this, in direct contrast, is. Again, aesthetically, performance-wise, execution of the editing and direction and lighting, the design of the world, the texture of the entire world and texture of the piece. I'm just in love with this film. And yeah, it lists itself as a grim fairy tale, kind of like a play on words there, and it truly is. But just even in the way, like, they speak in the film and lead you on this journey, it's very dreamlike. And then once you get to the witch and you see how he sort of designed sort of and sort of retold the sort of trappings of the tale, it's gorgeous and disgusting and disturbing, but so good. And I was very happy with the ending of the film, and just like the runtime again is like it's another short like 90 minutes, and I love myself a long film as well, like, don't get me wrong, but the way they did it is just, again, amazing. That's my another one of my words, amazing, top-notch. And now, unfortunately, it's only been released on DVD in Australia, which is one of the, like, the best shot films of the year. Hopefully, I'm going to score an international Blu-ray, because that's my plan. And we have reached the penultimate, number 2 on the list of the top 10 of the year. And, my God. Like I said before, nothing on this list is set in stone. I don't really believe in the ranking of them. They're all, like, equal and beautiful in my mind's eye, but this, if I did have to really set things in stone, this and number 1 are definitely my tops of the year. They, like, what come to mind when I think of this year in films, like, instantly, in terms of, like, the emotional impacts on it. And this one is Lee Whannell's The Invisible Man, which I saw just before the pandemic really bloomed, and fortunately took over the world and caused so much tragedy and trauma. But speaking of trauma and tragedy, this film has it in spades, absolute spades. And this is, of course, a reimagining of not only the classic Universal Monsters sort of Invisible Man character and films and sequels over the years, but also a reimagining of H.G. Wells' original tale. So this adaptation is from the perspective of not the Invisible Man, but Cecilia, a woman played by Elizabeth Moss, as she sort of escaped an abusive relationship. And my God, the fear that is reaped out of perspective and trauma and like the real world elements embedded into this is what makes this film work and tick. And not only that, but like the supporting cast of Aldous Hodge, Storm Reid, Michael Dorman, and Oliver Jackson Cohen from Haunting the Hill House playing the Invisible Man, this top tier horror that really just chills your spine and like is what left such a brilliant impact on me. But I couldn't wait to get my hands on the Blu-ray again and rewatch it. So upsetting and so technically brilliant. Cinematography especially, and just the movement of the camera and direction and lighting and all the technical elements are so pitch perfectly tuned into selling us this fear and this tale overall. And I was so deeply impressed. And Lee Whannell's been like one of my favorite sort of writer performer directors for a while, but this film really cements his sort of status, and I'm glad he got so much recognition and praise for this, because this is top notch.
And we're back for the number one picks, the dun 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 drum roll please. Favorite movies of the year. Peter Gray, what is your favorite movie of the year?
My number one movie, it's weird because it's like my favorite movies of the year are always different from like the movies that I think are the best.
Yeah,
you know, like like Birds of Prey would probably be like up there as my favorite, but so my number one movie of the year is Nomadland.
Right. Yeah, I just saw this one yesterday.
Yeah, like again, a movie that hits a lot harder in 2020.
Oh boy.
And very much a movie that feels like a documentary, because
the
really
blend
apart
between the two is like,
yeah, because
seamless.
Really apart from Frances McDormand and David Strathairn, everyone else is a
real person.
Is a real person, and they're all real nomads.
Have you seen her other film, The Rider?
The Rider, yes.
Yeah, yeah. It's on Netflix
so,
in Australia at the moment.
Yeah, Chloe Zhao is so far she's 2 for 2.
Yeah, and she's got another film that she's made, I think, in Chinese, and I cannot get access to it. It's on Prime in like America, and that's it. And I cannot access it on DVD.
Okay,
you cannot even get it illegally. Like that is how hard this movie is to get, and I'm really, really, really mad.
But no, like it's like.
Oh no, it's Songs My Brothers Taught Me. So it's an American one.
Yeah. Simplest plot. Like there's not really much to this movie plot wise.
Yeah.
When you sort of look at it as an overall. And you know, like when it opens with the statistic that this town
got wiped out
because of the plant shut down.
Yeah.
And basically the whole town, like they were all like workers of this plant. So when that shut down, the town just dissipated. The zip code was discontinued because the whole town literally just didn't exist anymore. So everyone kind of went in to do their thing. And Frances McDormand is, you know, just goes from town to town trying to find seasonal work. So like when you see her
there's packing up at an Amazon warehouse.
There
are no more terrifying shots this year than the shots of the Amazon warehouse.
Yeah.
I just wanted to cry.
So it's like this this ridiculous warehouse, all of these people packing boxes for stuff that you're like, that all these people that have ordered that they don't need, you know, and it's like...
And getting paid peanuts.
You know, and then they go off and have to find...
More work,
you know? And I just love that it's just this woman who... wants to find happiness the way that she wants to find happiness. And if that's not necessarily what other people think is happiness, then that's okay.
Beautifully shot.
I think when she said, I'm not homeless, I just don't have a home. Yeah. I don't have a house.
I'm houseless.
Yeah, I'm houseless. I was like,
It's a movie that understands America in a way that very few movies do.
It's like a movie that understands America better than America understands itself.
Correct. Shots of the
landscape. Oh, It really is like a beautiful film to look at.
Yeah.
You know, like when she's just like lounging in the lake and under the waterfall and like driving across country. And then, but then you've got scenes where she like goes to see a family that are just incredibly uncomfortable because you can tell that they don't agree with her lifestyle. And she's like, what's it to you?
Yeah.
You know, and she lives in this, like she seems happy, you know? And I think a lot of people are like, but you don't have a home and you don't have like, possessions, and it's like it's okay not to have those things, you know.
Another scene that gets an audible gasp when the box breaks, that everyone knew immediately that was like
and then you feel really bad for David Strathairn when she's really angry at him
because he doesn't know
bless his heart.
It made me want to go back and watch Good Night and Good Luck.
Yeah.
Just seeing him in this, I was like, oh yeah, he's really good.
And you know, again, it's like Frances McDormand will absolutely be in the running. There's like no way. And basically, like, I haven't seen all of the female performances that I want to see, because there's one that I very much want to see that I won't be able to see till March.
Oh, what one's that?
French Exit.
Oh, yes. The Michelle Pfeiffer one.
Which, I'm like, she's the one that deserves an Oscar right now. I don't care if I haven't seen it. But yeah, I was like, I feel like Frances McDormand potentially has her third Oscar. And, you know, it's one of those things where you go, I'm not going to be surprised. But
yeah.
There are a lot of other people that can get nominated this year.
But
like Chloe Zhao, like,
if she's not nominated at the very least,
we cry foul, because there's no way that this isn't just one of the most exquisitely shot movies.
Yeah.
You know,
and exquisitely like felt.
Yeah.
She gives the time to the things that people don't give time to.
Like, this feels really personal to something that you like have. Like, you go, Frances McDormand, you know, and Chloe Zhao, I feel like this isn't a lifestyle that you've experienced.
Yeah. But the way she immerses herself into her subjects, the way she did with the writer and the way she did with that, means that it's nothing but honest.
Yeah.
So that's where her skill set lies. And the blending of the real and the scripted is flawless. I've seen some try to do something similar, and there's always a hard line between the two.
Yeah.
And she blurs that so easily,
like,
and effortlessly.
There are times when you forget that Frances McDormand is Frances McDormand.
Yeah.
Like when she's just talking to, I forgot the name. It's like Swanky.
I think it's Swanky.
When they're just talking, you know, and it's these women who are like, well, you're a fresh nomad. You know, we've done this sort of thing.
Yeah.
But you feel like you're just watching three women talking about their life. Like, you never did that. And then you sort of have to go, no, it's Frances McDormand, it's a movie. But that's how incredible it is that you never feel that you're watching a movie.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And again, not a movie that I was like, it's not a movie that I can relate to per se. But I very much appreciated
America needs to watch it, that's for sure.
Yeah. But I very much appreciated that it was basically saying, find your happy however you can. And it doesn't matter what other people think. It's like, if this is what you want to do, then just look inward to yourself and find it. Like,
yeah.
I think that's really great. As like sappy as that sounds. but no, just incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. My number one pick, and I've been raving about it since I saw it first in June, is the tiny little independent gay comedy called Straight Up. Which tells the story. So it's a chance meeting brings a nearly perfect couple together in LA, except that he's gay and she's not. Compounding this is that he suffers through OCD as he house sits and she struggles to be accepted as an actress. Their otherwise rightness is obvious, but friends, especially those in the gay community, believe in the clear lines of sexuality being drawn. So it's basically a rom-com without the sex. And
I know someone on Twitter will be happy about that. No sex.
Well, what's fascinating is he sits there and is like, I'm going to try and be straight now. And I thought, just because I heard about this in a couple of festival things, and I thought, oh, just that premise seemed icky to me in a way where I thought it'd be tropey and very kitschy.
Even though gay men wanting to be straight is something I think a lot of gay men can relate to.
Yes.
Because you're like, you know, not that we have any shame in, well, in,
shame is the key reason why.
There's not that we have any shame in being gay. It's like we have the shame of how it's perceived.
Yeah.
And you obviously, yes, being straight would obviously mean we'd have an easier life.
Yeah.
But I don't know too many gay men that would actually say, I want to be straight.
Yeah.
So I get that the whole thing about wanting to be straight with air quotes, meaning like to make it easier for myself to live, you know? Yeah.
And in the story, because his whole thing is it's his relationship to sex that he has trouble with. And I've heard a couple of people sort of get upset that this film doesn't talk about asexuality in a more prominent way. I mean, it's brought up quite clearly, but the thing is that it's not an aversion to sex. It's his OCD that gets in the way.
Yeah.
He says, when I think about sex, I think about poop, and I don't want to think about poop. And there's another scene about halfway through the film where there's a joke about two girls, one cup, and he doesn't know what it is. And she says, oh, it's about poop. And he's like, oh, no, don't say it. So it's his OCD is getting in the way rather than...
I mean, he's got a fair point.
Yes. But this film, so it's written, directed, and starring this young-ass Asian-American director. They get Randall Park to come in and play his dad.
Oh, Randall Park.
To play his dad. And
I'm weirdly sexually attracted to Randall Park.
No, it's perfectly acceptable. But for him to be that young and to be pulling off this movie, it's a Wes Anderson vibe. They shoot it in like the 4:3 Academy ratio and it's got this very symmetrical framing. But what's really great is it's so tied into the character because they shoot Todd, the main guy, like this. And then they shoot Rory handheld. Style matches the person that they're in the perspective of it in one time. Okay. And they do this, there's this phenomenal split screen sequence where the camera starts with them together and then splits into two things.
Okay.
And it's visually one of the most phenomenally directed things I've ever seen.
Yeah.
The fact that he's that young and doing it just makes me immensely jealous.
Don't you hate that?
Because like, it's a micro budget somewhere in the realm of under 800,000, under 500,000, I think even.
Wow.
But this did quite well in a couple of queer festivals. And then just as they got a cinema release, COVID hit. It kind of destroyed them. But I went and bought this on a hideously expensive DVD off of Amazon because I had to get it imported. It was like $45 for a DVD, but it's not available on Blu-ray, which is really mad. But I needed to own this one because it's one of my favorite films, and the other big thing is they're talking at like lightning fast speed, like an old screwball comedy.
Okay.
It's banter. They're talking unbelievably fast. They joke about Gilmore Girls in the movie. They joke, you know, so that's where it's clearly coming from, that sort of vibe.
Yeah.
And her and him just do a phenomenal. She's from did you ever watch How to Get Away with Murder?
Mm-hmm.
She's the one who comes in to be with Wes after the first girl dies. Her name is James Sweeney is the lead actor, and her name's Katie Finlay, and she's shown up in this, but she actually gets to really kind of play a role, and she's playing an actress, and she, you know, they cut to her doing like some dodgy auditions for these really poorly written female characters, and there's just these phenomenal jokes about that. I'll put the trailer in the show notes and everything like that, and it's streaming on Netflix in America. So if you have a VPN, or like I do, or, you know, you're in America, highly recommend it. I've been raving about this film to as many people as I can. Every time I get an every time someone's like, what's a movie you really like from this year that not enough people are talking about? I'm like, straight up. So good. It's phenomenal film. I have already rewatched it like 3 times now. It's perfect. It is so well directed. It is queer excellence and is my number one film of 2020. Josh, what's yours?
And here we are. My number one pick of the year is The Personal History of David Copperfield. And I don't want to mispronounce his last name, but the film was directed by Armando, who directed The Death of Stalin a few years back. The film stars Dev Patel as David Copperfield, Peter Capaldi, Ben Whishaw, Tilda Swinton, Gwendolyn Christie, Hugh Laurie, Anthony Welsh, Benedict Wong, like so many others, and it's brought me to absolute tears. And like I said with The Invisible Man, this one, even though every film in my mind is, again, equal, this one, if I think about the films in 2020, this one cements itself as the heart of 2020 film in my mind. And I know I've still missed out on a few films this year, but I don't think this will change because everything just from the ground up on this film worked for me. The score was gorgeous. I listened to it on repeat all the time. The performances, the script, the comedy, the costuming, the goddamn scene transitions is something to behold. It's so massively done. And this works so well with the lighting, the way it's sort of executing the story and telling the story. Like, again, Leon, I was thinking, this, like, it's perfectly tuned. And this is what I love about films that actually have a voice and actually use the cinematic grammar and language to actually tell the story instead of just shooting things like a play. Like, we're making films here, and this is the point. And this film represents that on every level, and I'm so in love with this. Again, it's another one of those things where it did not get a Blu-ray release in Australia, and I believe that's criminal. That's just disgusting to me, and I will be purchasing a Blu-ray when I can internationally. If you do want to check it out, still check it out, DVD and VOD, and like enjoy the hell out of this, because how can you not? Deb Patel is just on another level in this, and everyone in the cast is gorgeous. I'm attracted to everybody, of course. This is, of course, I could not go into this without being that way, but God, this film this made me so happy. And it's a film I needed because I saw this, again, safely in the cinema. And I'm so glad I did because it plays so well big despite being so intimate. Yeah, I just knew this was going to be my favorite of the year, at least. Like, it just washed over me in all its beautiful glory. And yeah, this represents 2020 to me in terms of all the beauty. I'm so happy. Such a great film. Sort of overwhelmed. And that's it. That's my list. That's to wrap it up in 2020. I know, again, I said I missed a fair few films just because I was so lost in the comfort of old films. Like, older films, should I say. Both new to me and well-known to me. Like, I got to see so much this year, and I was so happy about. But realistically, but like, the films I did get to see that were released this year or released last year and distributed later in Australia, like, I'm excited to check out the ones I missed and the ones that are on everyone else's list across the table here, virtually. Because I am somewhere else in my own home, not anywhere mysterious. No, 2020 was very rough, but the cinema was grand. I just want to say thank you to everyone who's listened to this podcast for the last like 3 years, because it's, for me personally, finishing off, I was still in uni when we started this, and finishing off so many other projects and going through so many life changes, and it's been such a cool experience and sort of experiment to see. And like, I love being able to, you know, grow some skill sets, and I'm excited for what Shane and I do next in terms of our film careers and in the podcast sphere. Yeah, I'll be excited to bring you more like great sort of stories, even if I'm doing fictional stuff, non-fictional stuff. It'd be really fun to talk to you guys again. And so yeah, thank you. And I just wanted to say, stay safe out there for the last time from the Mighty Motion Picture Rangers. Back to you, Shane, and have at it. Thank you.
So that's it. That's for a top 10 of 2020, and that's it for this podcast, dude. Aww. Sad face. Thank you so much for coming on, and thank you for all your previous guest appearances, Peter. You have been one of my favorite guests.
Oh, stop. No, like, it's just, I mean, it's always good to talk about movies with someone who actually
watches them,
appreciates them. And, you know, if you're someone who, if you have a differing opinion, you at least, like, you respect that. Like, yes. That's the thing that it's really hard to find when you, if you don't like something, then someone's like,
except people who hate The Last Jedi, they're wrong.
And everyone who's like shitting on Wonder Woman 84, like, bloody hell.
It's a bit, I think it's an overreaction, because in any other year, it would be a, even if they didn't like it, it would be a, that was whatever film. Like, yeah. It's not like the worst movie ever made.
Because it's like, they've been starved of blockbusters.
And so now they get this one, and that's it.
You know, like, ease up. Jesus. Yeah.
But if you don't like that, then there's so much like indie stuff.
It's fine if you don't like it. Just don't make people feel like shit if they do like it. The same way that we don't make you feel like shit if you don't like something, you know?
Unless it's The Last Jedi.
It's just like, yeah. But that's what I've appreciated, because, and appreciate. It's not like I'm never going to see you again. But that, yeah, like that you just have an opinion that doesn't, you know, you don't think you're better than the other person if their opinion
is
different.
But I am
better. I mean, publicly you can, and then privately just like, they're wrong.
But it's also been a great year. I think it's been a really fantastic year for small, like, that's the thing, is that like, if big blockbusters, if you're getting a bit fatigued off them, check out some of these tiny films, because there's a lot of tiny films. Go to like tiny little Vimeo on demand stuff that's made for no money, and you'll find something weird and cool and different, and it's not going to be the best film ever made, but it's, I feel like every film doesn't have to be the best film ever made, or then it's the worst film ever made. Like, there is in between.
And now that a lot of festivals are going virtual, like, you can buy tickets to watch these movies. Yeah. And now you've kind of got no excuse. Yeah. Because
I'm
like,
so glad Q-Screen are now doing online again next
year. Yeah, like, you can, like, regardless of where you are in the world, if VPNs definitely help you. I know some festivals are actually, like, trying to stop that.
I don't know why.
I don't know how, and I don't know why. But no, I just, like, 2020, it's really bizarre that 2020 has turned out to be one of the strongest years.
It's one of the most varied and different. Yeah. Like, my films previously have sort of veered to one way or the other, but, like, this is one of the most, like, about half of these directed by women.
Yeah.
A little less than half of them starring people who aren't white.
Who aren't,
especially Straight Up. And, you know, this, you know, queer film with an Asian American lead, like, fantastic.
You know, yeah.
And just the stories are weird. And I love that. Yeah. I love how weird some of these
Like, I really hope that these little films don't get overshadowed next year, because obviously next year is looking like there'll be so many. Although now June is not necessarily on HBO Max. Apparently he's like not happy because no one's happy about that deal. So
it's clear the movie's not going to make enough money.
Kind of love that he's fighting it, because
I do. But, you know, but I mean, Tenet kind of screwed the pooch on that, didn't it?
At the same time, I'm like,
I love Tenet,
but at the same time, I don't like that they're referring to Tenet as a flop.
It's a flop in the way that every other film, Nolan film, has been a hit.
Yeah, but at the same time, I was like, you made $350 million in a pandemic.
Yeah.
So let's like not, you know, and it's funny because now Wonder Woman 84, like it made $16 million from cinema in America and $85 million worldwide. And that's like, it's amazing. Wonder Woman 3, greenlit. So you just go, so how come $350 million for Tenet is a flop, and yet Wonder Woman 1984, the money it's made in its pandemic is not? I was like, I don't, you know, like I love that we're getting Wonder Woman 3 after everything now. I was like, that's the best news ever. Suck it. But I just don't like that Tenet's sort of being referred to as this like flop that like ruined cinema chances. I'm like, it didn't. I was like, I think they
wanted Inception money.
Yeah. And I was like, you're never going to get Inception money.
Because like Interstellar did like 500 or 600 and I think they wanted it to hit there at least.
And I get half of that. You know, and I get that. But at the same time you go, but you look at the state of the world.
It's pretty great too.
And you just go, yeah, I like that. Yeah. But yeah, you look at the state of the world and go, it did
phenomenal what it was
for what it was dealing with. But I also love that Birds of Prey is now one of the top 10 highest grosses of the year, because I really hated the storyline for that with its box office money.
It being a flop. Like, what the fuck? It's not a flop. It's a giant hit. But thank you anyway. It's been a fantastic year for cinema. It's hopefully, you know, big changes coming, so we'll see how next year pans out. But keep watching movies, everyone. I'm sure you'll hear from us again sometime, Josh and I, in one form or another, and listen to other great, fantastic shows on That's Not Canon. It's a great network, and they've got so many shows for all different interests. Thank you guys so much for listening. And hopefully we'll see you again. We'll see you down the road.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.